convention, January 29th, 1973, on the theme, announced theme topic, Minui Hatayonim.
And the bracha la'asot b'divrei Torah, which is said by the Yachid as part of the Birkat Hatzachah. The Asher Bracha Rabbanu refers to the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, the quest to know, to formulate critically, to satisfy ourselves intellectually. It involves logical analysis, consistency, and exact methodology. On the words Vishinatam Lupaneka, Lupaneka, the Chazal adds, Shehinu is preserving the Sifa. They should be sharp and precise in its clarity of understanding. In addition to the intellectual enrichment, Asher Bracha Rabbanu also involves the volitional. A promise not only to know, but to abide, to be obedient, to observe, to realize his moral kingdom on earth. We have thus not only little modes of alamed, but also lishmal velasa, the intellectual and the volitional. The last of the Dibrekara, in sharp contrast, suggests a total emotional personality commitment, a longing for God's word as a precious treasure which promises bliss, ecstasy, and supreme happiness. Here we deal not with Shinantam, but with Asher Nochi Mitzvacha Hayom Alavavecha, with the emphasis Alavavecha. The Rabbeinu Tam tells us that the Ha'arevna is an extension of the Vecha of Lassa to Dibre Torah. May the Torah be sweet in our mouths. Of course, we all concede, and proudly so, that the Rav has enriched us with Torah learning over the course of many years, but the Shinantam experience as only he can impart it. And besides our intellectual delight, we are also volitionally impelled to become more stringent in our observance and more meticulous in our behavior. What needs, however, to be mentioned is that he's also given us a geschmack, a beharevna, an emotional feeling of what we're last supposed to do Torah. As Rabbanim charged with the responsibility of inspiring our congregation to Torah, it is the La'asot, even more than the Limud Torah, that is more vitally important. It is the love and the emotional receptivity to Torah which must precede the actual transmission of Torah. It is with this acknowledgement of our indebtedness to our Rebbe for both the Shinantam Lubanecha and Alavavecha that I am privileged to present to this conference Moveinu V'Raveinu Harav Yosef Dov Zeher Soloveitchik.
Okay. What is the topic of the... I didn't say it. Did I say it? No. I didn't say it. I've not been said it yet.
I expected that.
The Kasha deals with Midrash Hagayonim, that's correct. I'll just concern myself with one pasuk. Vayim Mocharos, Vayesh Moshe Lishpet Esorom. Vayam Eidrom Al Moshe Min Aboker Ad Erev. What came to pass on the morrow, what Moshe said to judge the people, and the people stood by Moshe from the morning until the evening. There is a short remark in Ramban There's a short remark in Mechilta. Rashi has elaborated the Mechilta. But you'll find, I mean, this particular interpretation in the Mechilta as well as in the Ramban and in Rashi. Bahim Mochoros, Mochoros Yem HaKippurim. Or as Rashi expressed himself, Bemitzoy Yem HaKippurim. And the moral of Yom Kippur. The Rashi proves, I mean, that this statement is correct, because according to Rashi, Yisrael came the first year after Matan Torah, even though it's a Machlokes HaTanoim, and between Shavuos and Mochos Yom HaKippurim, Moshe had no time, I mean, to receive Yisrael. Because he went up Mount Sinai and then came down, found the eagle, shattered the luchas, came up again, and then went down again, and then climbed up the mount again for the last 40 days. So the only day on which Moshe could have received the Yisrael was sit down, Moshe could sit down and judge the people, was the day after Yom Kippur, Rosh. But however, the Mechilta, as well as the Ramban, don't try to prove. They just state, I mean, in a few words, as Memochas refers to Yom Kippur. Memochas Yom Kippur. And the more of Yom Kippur. Or, in other words, and the more of his return from Mount Sinai. Because this was the first Yom Kippur in Jewish history. And with Sliche, Mechile, forgiveness and grace was granted to the people by the Almighty. And Moshe descended from the mountain on Yom Kippur. In other words, the Memochoras is not related, according to Rashi and Ramban and the Mechilta, to the event to which the Torah has recorded in the preceding chapter, namely the arrival of Yisrael. As a matter of fact, the Ibn Ezra interprets the Memochoras by relating it to the arrival of Yisrael and the marrow of Yisrael's arrival, but to another event, namely the descent of Moshe from Mount Sinai after having spent there 20 days, or on the marrow of Yom Kippur. Question is why? What pressed Chazal in the Mechilta, Rashi and Ramban to relate the story of Yeshev Moshe Mishpat Esrom to Yom Kippur? In order to understand that, we will have to analyze semantically the term Mimochoras. The term Mimochoras, whenever it is used by the Torah, has an axiological component, an axiological element, or I would say contains a value judgment. By using the term Mimochoras, one attempts either to explain the worthiness and the dignity of today by attaching it to yesterday. Somehow the glory of today consists in the fact that today is very close to yesterday. The source of glory, the source of dignity is yesterday, not today. But today is somehow appended to Kedusha. As we have in Chazal, that Eis yes atfilis Hashem, elekecho, dechof, elekecho, dechof, elekechem, chof shlosmem, our Kodesh, are in doubt with Kedusha. Why? Because we follow Hashem. They are appended, or they are attached to the divine name. So whenever the in many cases, the Torah uses Mimochoras in order to tell us the story that today is dignified and worthy of great things, because it is a needful Lashem. It is appended and attached to yesterday. And at certain times, the Torah employs the memochros, the adverb of memochros, the adverb of time designation of memochros, to denounce the yesterday, just in opposite way, and to contrast between the shameful yesterday and the dignified today. I'll give you just two examples. Each example will characterize the semantics of memochros. As I told you, the semantics is a twofold one. Let us take the verse in Kisiso. Vayim memochros, vayim ameshi aloom, atem chatosem chato ogdilo. Vayishma aloom et adobar ara haze, vayisaboro. And it came to pass on the morrow, again on the morrow, that Moshe said unto the people, ye have sinned a great sin. And when the people heard the evil tidings, they mourned. What is the semantics of the memochros in context of the story of the Hegel? The memochros contrasts the Esmael, the yesterday, which was replete with noisy merrymaking, undisciplined hilarity, and complete addiction to pleasure, which was replete with wild dances and abominable orgies and complete self-abandonment. And the people rose up to make merry. The memochros denotes or has the connotation of the moral of a day, of the moral, which is a day of sobering up, of regaining perspective, of reappraising what happened a day before. And hence, the morrow, the memochros, is a day of mourning, of repentance and contrition. The memochros in this context signifies the miraculous metamorphosis from sin into tshuva. Yesterday was their evil. Yesterday was a night of a day of drunkenness, intoxication. Yesterday was a day of permissiveness and orgiastic pleasure. Yesterday was a day of idol worshipping and complete self-abandonment. Today is a day of mourning, a day of contrition, a day of tshuva. Yesterday is denounced, that today is affirmed. Today, what happened today? The rebirth of the people. What happened yesterday is simply the downfall of the people. Yesterday the people fell. Today the people rose. Yesterday is denounced. Today is affirmed. In similar vein, we may interpret another term which is, I would say, very close to memochros. I mean the term Vayashkimu Baboker, in the chapter dealing with the Meraglim, with the scouts. The phrase which the Torah employs in order to portray the change which came over the people in the course of one night is not memochros, but Vayashkimu Baboker. However, it is very significant. The semantics are the same. Vayashkimu Baboker, Vayalu al Reish Or, ואימר, הננו, הננו ויולינו אל המוקים אשר אומר עד השם, כי חותנו. And we rose up early in the morning and got up the top of the mountain saying, "Lo, we are here and we will go up into the place which the Lord has promised, for we have sinned." Again, the night before was one of mortal fear and black, insane despair. They fell, the night before they fell, as if all avenues of escape were sealed off. Vayifko on Balaylahu, and the people wept that night. But with the rising, the star of the morning star, the people began gradually to liberate themselves from the clutches of monstrous terror and resignation, and the new light, spiritual light, went on, and many things they did not understand the night before became clear in the morning. They began to believe in the Almighty, in His promises. Vayeshkinu Babeker is the story again of miraculous transformation of a nightmare into a clear vision, a change of a cowardly mob in an enlightened people. It happens over one night. In Yehadus, downfall and rise are not separated by a long period of time. Downfall and rise succeed each other within a short period of time, in the course of one night, in the course of one day. And when the Torah speaks Mochros, means yesterday, it was a day of sin and complete moral collapse. Today, or of the fall from the Almighty, today is the day of rising back to greatness. However, as I told you, there is another meaning to Memochos, just opposite. The yesterday is not announced. On the contrary, yesterday is singled out, and that today, in order to attain worthiness, dignity, Kedusha must attend itself or attach itself to the yesterday. At times, the Memochos denotes not change, but on the contrary, just the opposite, changeless continuity. The yesterday, today, is a continuation of the yesterday. Persistent identity. The Mochos signifies the lingering on of an experience. The Mochos ascertains the fact that an experience quite often is not extinguished with the passage of time. The term Mochos in this context is indicative, of course, of the Jew's longing for Kedusha, his clinging to Kedusha, and his refusal to let her go. While the Memochos within the context of the story of the eagle, and the Memochos within the context of the story of the scouts, denotes change. So the Memochos, in another context, I'll read the pasuk, signifies just the opposite, continuity. The today is nothing but a reflection of the yesterday. What possibly do you have in mind, huh? Correct. Usfartem lochem imochros ha-shavos Miyena v'achem esem erat nufo Sheva shavos ha-istimistigeno Ad nimochros ha-shavos ha-shvili Tisper lochem mishiyen. The day following the Shabbat, the Shabbos, the festival, is not just an ordinary day, The day is not just another bleak, dreary, undistinguished day. By no means. The day is the marrow of the Sabbath, a continuation of the holiday. It is endowed with specific meaning. It radiates in iridescent light. It reflects the glory of yesterday, the beauty of the Sabbath. Many halachos in Yahadut express the idea of the ceaseless continuity of the Memochros. The most prominent one, that somehow a great experience does not die with the passage of time. That the awareness of Gdusha does not wither with the passing of the day which is responsible for that awareness. And somehow there is a tendency on the part of the Jew to extend that awareness, I would say, ad infinitum. Of course, he is not successful in that. But extend it a little more, beyond the boundaries within which the Jew found the source of Kedusha. And this is the halacha, of course. This is the precept of Teisvah Shabbos Yontif. Nisifim Mechel al HaKedesh. Of course, it's halacha. But halacha reflects an inner tendency in the Jew, a longing, a craving in the Jew for Kedusha, and his stubborn refusal to part with it. The Jew rushes into the Shabbos with impatience, but is very slow to part with her. The next day is not just a day, but memochavos. On the morrow, it is not endowed with intrinsic dusha, certainly not. However, it is appended to Kedusha. When I speak about that, this is Shabbos as reflecting the longing of the Jew for Kedusha, his despair in a profane, dreary, bleak, everyday world, and his joy with Kedusha, I remind myself of a scene which I once witnessed in Warsaw as a young boy. And I walked into a Chassidish Shtibu. I believe they were Moshe Chassidim. I don't remember exactly. And we were singing at Shalashur. It was quite late. And the Snagash brought me to Rosh Hashanah, the Shabbos, and was already the Beit Feld out to the Shabbos, and the stores were open. But in that Chassidish Shtibu, they were still singing Bnei Cholo. And Hashem Reir Echsov and Yideshi Avetzeni. And there was a little Jew there, a very short in stature, a little Jew. And he was wearing a satin capote. There were more holes than buttons, or threads in that capote. And he was so enchanted and so mesmerized by singing and Shemrei Ve'echshor that I couldn't identify him, I didn't recognize him. Then he came over to me and said, "Do you know me?" I said, "No." "Oh, you see me every time." At the Iron Gate, it's a famous square in Warsaw, where all the coolies used to assemble there. The porters. Yes. The porters. You saw me. I reminded myself of him, I identified him. The little man was very short in stature. And used to carry in Warsaw, tables and heavy pieces of furniture. So the whole day, the whole week, he worked very hard, like a coolie, like a Chinese coolie. And Shabbos, he turned into, as Highness said, into a prince. But he did not want to part with the role of a prince. He played just 24 hours every week. He refused to return to his abode of, let's say, this profane abode of bleakness and dreariness and nausea. And he tried to prolong the Shabbos as much as possible. But this is not only, this is true not only of one individual, it is true of the Jewish people as such. And the Aloche of Tis v'Shabbos Nesifim v'Chedor HaKedesh, which I did write, reflects, mirrors that longing in the Jew. Now, of course, in the light of the Bar said, when you begin to understand the term Mochros, that Chazal has many times, not here is not the only place, many times, whenever the Pasuk speaks Mochros, and we are in doubt to what the Mochros is related. So Chazal always come in, Mochros Yom HaKippurim. In the light of that, what we have just said, we understand the expression Mochros Yom HaKippurim, which we come across quite frequently in Talmudic and Midrashic literature. A Jew does not just observe Yom Kippur. He experiences Yom Kippur as the great day of reconciliation on which God and man meet, as the day of God-man companionship, if not the Shem Tidhor. That's Yom Kippur, the experience. Not the day per se, the calendaric day, but the day as experienced by the Jew never terminates, never comes to a close. The glorious experience does not disappear immediately with the conclusion of the fast. It lives on and accompanies man into the profane, practical, and cynical world. The idea of Yom Kippur has a cathartic influence on the awareness of the Jew. It enriches his personality and sanctifies his heart. The experience of Yom Kippur and the philosophy of the day is not abundant with the conclusion of the day. It lingers on and accompanies the Jew throughout the Nimochras. And the Mochas of Yom HaKippurim, according to the concept of the Aloch and Agore, should not be limited to one day, but should extend throughout the year. And here, we come across a novel idea, namely, that the idea that Mishpat, call it righteousness, call it justice, I don't care how you translate it. And the human role in the administration of Mishpat is inseparable from the concept of Memochos Yom HaKippurim. Vayeshev Meshe Lishpet Esom, Vayim Memochos, Vayeshev Meshe Lishpet Esom, whenever Moses sat in judgment and acted like a justice, like a magistrate, like a dayan, like a shepherd, it was for him the day, it was for him Mimochros Yom HaKippurim. And let me explain it to you, I believe, by employing a few halachic concepts. We know, I mean, whoever witnessed what you call a din teireh, or ever was raised in a rabbinic home, and I had the fortune or the misfortune to be raised in such a home, that most din teireh, most controversies, most cases of litigation which came before the rabbi, before my father or my grandfather, ended not in a verdict based upon the strict law, what do you call and the Gemara called? Pshore. Either Pshore or Bitsua. We'll see next what semantically the difference is between Pshore and Bitsua. Pshore or Bitsua As a matter of fact, my father told me that he was told by the Chaim. After all, he was rabbi in Brisk for 30, 35 years, that he has never rendered a verdict based upon the strict letter of the law. All controversies, all kinds of litigation, and that in a verdict based on Pshore. Pshore or Bitsua, within the halachic juridic context, is not just a way out of a difficult and long litigation, like sometimes a case which somehow a complicated case in court is finally, turned over to arbitration. It isn't so. But Pshore is the ideal legal solution of any civil controversy. The legal solution, the ideal legal solution, is not a verdict in terms of strict law, but a verdict of Pshagdin in terms of Pshore or Bitsua. The authority of the Dayan is not curtailed by the consent of both parties to resolve the matter by Pshore. And I purposely avoid the term arbitration, which corresponds to our institution of Zad Lo, Zed Beir Aleichot, and Zed Beir Aleichot, rather than to Pshore. The term arbitration and Zad Lo, have very little in common with Pshore. After the parties agree to settle the dispute by Pshore, the Dayan exercises his authority in the same manner and fashion as in a case of a strictly din Torah decision. The formal kinyan, and I cannot go into halachic details here, the formal kinyan, we've accepted the view that Pshore tzricho kinyan. As a matter of fact, there are one man domar in Sanhedrin is of the opinion that you don't need a kinyan in order to clinch the Pshore. You simply, if the Baledinim accept it, is enough. Yes. But we have accepted the viewpoint of the man domar of the mayor of Pshore tzricho kinyan. But I want to emphasize something. The kinyan sets up the Besdin as the legal authority, but there is no direct obligation on the part of the litigant to give or to renounce a certain amount of money. Tosafot already noticed that in case of direct assumption of indebtedness, the plaintiff, the teveya, would require no kinyan, since Mechila is not subject to kinyan. On the other hand, as far as the mitva is concerned, kinyan would not suffice, since the amount is a dovash in a katzuf, you don't know how much you will have to give, and it falls under the category of asmachta. But to separate aloche of kinyan, which sets up the court, as a matter of fact, it's very hard to define precisely the role of kinyan as far as Pshore is concerned. What does the kinyan accomplish? Who holds kinyan if I tell you, if I promise you $100 and I accept the kinyan, it is a direct, I assume, an obligation of giving you $100, that amount. But I'm sure I don't know yet whether how much the Dayan will tell me to give or how much the Dayan will tell the other party to renounce. I don't know. It's a dovash in a kotzuf. It comes under the asmachte. And still, Pshore is indispensable as far as kinyan is indispensable as far as Pshore is concerned. So, in short, it is hard to define the role of Pshore. But once the role of kinyan, Pshore, as far as Pshore is concerned, but once the court is set up and the authority established by the kinyan, then the dying acts not just as an arbiter, as an arbitrator, no, as a dying, as a shepherd. The Pshore For instance, the amount of money which the Dayanamim decide that the Nitvah should give to the Teveah, for instance, or the amount of money which the Nitvah, the Teveah, has to renounce, I mean, is the Pshore is not a product of just negotiating, but of judicial action of the strictest, a strict legal procedure consisting of hearing and sifting evidence, of listening to arguments, of ascertaining true facts, and formulating the exact viewpoint of the law. It's interesting that in order to render up sure, the dying has to know the exact viewpoint of the law, what the law is. As a matter of fact, we have a term for it, I mean, a technical term. Pshore akriva ledas. Pshore which is very close to the Din Torah. However, every pshore must be close to the Din Torah. Because pshore is not, as far as pshore is concerned, the dying does not have unlimited freedom to do or to say what he wants. He is obligated to follow, I mean, two authorities, namely, what two authorities? The Cheshe Mishpot, authority number one, and authority number two, his own conscience. I beg your pardon? Everything is determined by the Dayonim, and all procedural, technical details are applicable to Pshore and Din alike. I mean, for instance, all the halachas, certainly a Dayan who has been authorized by the parties or by the litigants to deliver a pshore verdict should not accept bribe, certainly, you understand. Yeah. And, I mean, all the procedural technical details, and there are many, I mean, Cheshe Mishpot apply to pshore as they do apply to Din. It's not just a free agreement reached by the parties with the help of an arbitrator. No, it is a verdict rendered by the Dayan, by the Shefet, in the same fashion as it is rendered when the Baladinim request a Din there. In a word, Pshore and Din are two aspects of halachic judicial action. You see and hear, in the Jewish law, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a jurist, but I have a little common sense. A thing which sometimes lawyers and jurists don't have. Yeah. In here, in my opinion, is the Jewish law unique and singular. I mean, if there is a jurist, a great jurist here, I don't want a mediocre jurist, a great jurist here to contradict me, I is invited. And here, it comes to the uniqueness of Jewish law comes to the fore. In other law systems, the judge, of course, may recommend arbitration or conciliation, but by recommending arbitration or conciliation, he eliminates himself from participating in the final resolving of the case. I mean, the judge on the bench cannot make a compromise. He has to simply to render a decision based on law. If he recommends a compromise, then it is turned, the case is turned over to some arbitrator or a chosen man. The role of the judge is to deliver a verdict which is based on the law. Yehadus considers Pshore as the function of the Dayan, of the Shefet, who renders a decision in the same manner, a Pshore decision, as he decides the problem at strict law. And by accepting a Pshore, and by recommending a Pshore, we have accepted the viewpoint of Rabbi Shua ben Koche, that mitzvah lifter, the Dayan should first, before he offers them,
And he should offer them the two alternatives. One, the Dintere, second, the Pshore. However, he should tell them. The preference should be given to the Pshore. This is the finest and the most ideal solution. And he is not somehow, violating any law, or somehow placing his own conscience, above the law in Chesh Mishpot. No, it is a part of his function. And the verdict of a Pshore is actually a Roe Mishpot Din, whatever applies, for instance, in Donim Balailo, would apply not only to Dintere, but to Pshore as well. For instance, a Bezen Shalegetes has no right to handle litigation, would apply to verdict of Din as well to verdict of Pshore. That, for instance, the Dayan should be, impartial and not show any preference to either of the parties. Applies to Din and Pshore as well. In a word, Pshore is Din. Whatever it is Din combined with the subjective feeling of the Dayan, with the dictates of his conscience. The philosophy which underlies the institution of Pshore, and it's a very unique institution, is a twofold one. I would say one aspect of that philosophy is of an ethical, metaphysical nature. And the other aspect is of social, moral nature. The Gemara Sanhedrin, I believe it's Yitzchak, derives the whole idea of Bitzua, of Pshore, from two verses. From the verse in Shmuel 2, in Samuel 2, from 8, and from a verse in Zechariah. The verse in Shmuel says, "Vayi David deisi mishpat tzedaka." The verse in Zechariah says, "Emes u'mishpat sholim, emes u'mishpat shalom, shiftu b'sharechem." I quote this passage verbatim. Rabbi Yeshua ben Kochay mer mitzvah v'tzeya. Shenemar emes u'mishpat sholim, shiftu b'sharechem. Bali b'mokim sheyesh mishpat ein sholim. B'mokim sheyesh sholim ein mishpat. Elo eize mishpat sheyesh b'sholim. Avei mer zeu ביצוע. וכן בדוד אין, אבל ידוד אין שמשפט וצדוקו. אבל לכל מוקם שיש משפט אין צדוקו, וצדוקו אין משפט, אבל איזו משפט שיש בצדוקו, אבל אין על זה ביצוע. ורבי שיר בן כוחה, הוא is the father of the הלוכה. כאן רבי מאיר contradicted him. רבי מאיר's opinion is that Adayan should not suggest to the parties, sure. But they should proceed along the lines of strict din Torah. Rabbi Shimon Kocher is the father of the institution of Pshore. So he explains Pshore by quoting, to Psukim. Vayi David eisi mishpat utdoko, un emes un mishpat sholim shiftu bisharechem. Why did he need two Psukim, two quotations, in order to justify his opinion? Apparently there are two aspects which we introduce in order to justify the institution of Pshore. In other words, there is a great dichotomy, let us see, of justice and peace. B'mokim sheyesh mishpat ein sholim, b'mokim sheyesh sholim ein mishpat. And there is also an antinomy of justice and charity. Mishpat tzedakah. Apparently, Rabbi Shimon ben Kocher thought that this dichotomy or antinomy, both dichotomies or antinomies, the one between justice and peace, and the one between justice and tzedakah and charity, can be reconciled in Bitzuah, in Pshat. In the Din Torah, in the strict Din Torah, there is Mishpat, there is justice, but there is not charity. There is justice, but not peace. In the Torah, you find both justice and peace, and justice and charity. Apparently, the Torah is the synthesis of justice and peace on the one hand, and justice and charity on the other hand. So let me tell you, vis-a-vis apparently the justitia civilis, means the sense of justice in Roman law, or in the common law now, justitia civilis, jihadus apparently knows of a different kind of justice, of a divine charitable justice, or justice of charity. It is two aspects which prima facie are mutually exclusive. Again, in contradistinction to the justitia civilis, Yehadus proclaimed not only Mishpat Tzedakah, but Mishpat Sholem as well. The justice somehow combined with peace. In short, there is apparently a double goal which Pshara pursues. Let me start with Mishpat Tzedakah. First, Mishpat Tzedakah. Din alone is justice. Pshara entails both justice and charity, Mishpat Tzedakah. Let us explain it in very practical terms. In the halls of justitia civilis, or in the so-called secular courts, one of the parties involved in litigation gets hurt, at times badly hurt. Matters of litigation are being resolved in 99 of the cases which come before the Bar of Justice. With this victory of one and humiliating defeat of the other one, justitia civilis has accepted the Aristotelian principle of contradiction, the famous logical principle of contradiction, in the same fashion as classical physics did. Aristotle, the principle of contradiction, says, if there is A and B, and A and B are mutually exclusive, they are contradictory, then either A is right, or B is completely wrong, or the reverse is true. B is completely right, and A is totally wrong. However, it is absurd to say A and B are both wrong or A and B are both right. Hence, therefore, justitia civilis knows that in every case of litigation, one of the litigants is right, while the other one is wrong. Hence, the right party wins, the wrong party loses. And both victory and loss are total, are complete. Yehadus, particularly the other one, which has never accepted the Aristotelian principle, never. The Aristotelian principle of contradiction, never. I can prove it by introducing 50 examples that the Halacha did not acknowledge, did not affirm the principle of contradiction. There are many concepts in the Halacha. We operate with concepts which are mutually exclusive and nevertheless both right.
As a matter of fact, if you know, there's no need to know too much about it, but a little bit about modern physics, is the latter has also abandoned the Aristotelian principle of contradiction. For instance, the wave theory of light and the particle theory of light, you know, the famous controversy in physics, are mutually exclusive. But now you'll find physicists operating with both at the same time. And this is not a discovery on the part of modern physics, it's an old halachic rule. Snake suya matrishim ze'ezeh, at shiyove akos vashlishi v'yachriya b'neihem, v'yimi v'yachriya b'neihem, many a time that both are right. You wouldn't say that at shiyove akos vashlishi v'yachriya b'neihem means that the one person is right, the other one is wrong. Chas v'sholem, how can you say? If it's a person in the Torah, it cannot be wrong. It's right. If v'yachriya b'neihem should be interpreted in terms of acceptance of both, even though they are contradictory and mutually right. Yahadus, in particular the Halacha, which has never accepted the Aristotelian principle of contradiction, and which quite often recognizes both the thesis and the antithesis as true, or sometimes as wrong, looks upon civil conflict from a completely different viewpoint, not like the Justitia Civilis. A human being, Yehadu says, and this is not only, what shall I say, an ethical statement, it's a metaphysical statement. A human being cannot be completely right. Even the most righteous person cannot be completely right. Why cannot he be completely right? Because he is finite. His finiteness and limitedness spell imperfection, not only in the intellectual, but also in the ethical moral realm as well. Man is never absolutely right. A finite being cannot achieve infinity in any realm. The conclusion from this metaphysical and theological premise that man can never be completely totally right is obvious. If the human being cannot be unqualifiedly, unreservedly right, then the reverse is also true. That the human being can never be absolutely, ultimately, unreservedly wrong. The human being is both wrong, right, and wrong. So the two parties, the two litigants, which appear before the Dayan, before the Shevet, are either both right or both wrong. Not, and the presupposition, which is accepted by the canon law and the Roman law, that the one is right and the one is wrong, is not acceptable to Yahadus. Two human beings involved in litigation in a civil suit, both of them are wrong, and if you want, both of them are right. And the words of the Torah, the Dikles HaTzadik, the Shuyas HaRosho, should be interpreted
in relative, not absolute terms. No man is an absolute tzaddik, no man is an absolute rosh. Therefore, Yehadus try to protect both litigants against the disgrace, and humiliation of total guilt and total defeat. Yehadus hated malicious joy and refused to let one of the litigants enjoy total victory and rejoice not so much in his winning the case as in the fact that his opponent was humiliated. Justice, charity, mishpat, tzedaka, requires that the resolving of a controversy, of a civil controversy, should end, that the civil controversy should end not in complete victory or full defeat, but in the defeat of both. At the level of Mishpat Tzedakah, there is no victor, and there is no defeated party. Both win, if you want to say, if it's both lose. Both give something away, that they and the Nifter. That they give away a part of the amount in the man, from the Nitzvah, the Nitzvah pays a part of the amount, which according to his assertion, assertions and statements, I mean, he doesn't owe. Both are the tickets. Or if you wish to substitute another phrase, I would say both win. The Shefet is concerned with both, and does not let the juridically entrenched and strong party to defeat the juridically weak party. This means, the way I interpret it, this is Mishpat Tzedakah. So what does it mean, Mishpat Shiesh B'Tzedakah now? What does it mean? There is no victor, no vanquished. Both are defeated. Both are winners. It's a matter of interpretation. This is called bitzua, not pshore. What does bitzua mean? What is the Hebrew? What are the Hebrew semantics of bitzua?
Break.
Break. Slice. Give up. Give away. Lose. Don't be a winner. Don't be a victor in the total sense of the word. Bitzua, cut. Gzeirus, famous Nardi Gvashleire. Gzeir, half a chance to this, half a chance to that. To the other litigants, it means no one should. If Shleimis said Gzeir, I want you to understand. If Shleimis said Gzeir, of course it was a test, of course. But however, the Gzeir itself contains truth. It means no. Neither should win. Both should lose. Half a chance. And this is exactly what Bitsua. Bitsua means gzeiro. Cut in the middle. Give a slice to this one, a slice to the other one. There will be no victor. There will be no defeated party. There will be no joy on the part of the winner. There will be no humiliation on the part of the loser. This is Mishpat Tzedakah. This is charity. It is just. Of course, Justitia Civilis doesn't understand it. The typically Jewish concept. This is Bitzua. Now, let us pick up the second aspect of Pshore. Mishpat Shalom. Shiktu Bishorechem. Again, we have to contrast the Jewish viewpoint with the viewpoint of the Justitia Civilis. Justitia Civilis is concerned with resolving a conflict, but not with reconciling the people involved in that conflict. This is not a part of Justitia Civilis. It is perhaps a task of a social worker, or a psychiatrist, or a psychologist, I don't know. But it's not the task of the judge. He resolves an issue, but he does not resolve a feud. Does not terminate a feud. This is perhaps the task of a rabbi, all right? As we pointed out above, the roles of Justitia Civilis total victory as well as total defeat. As a result of that, hatred deepens after the issue had been resolved. Antagonisms increase in intensity. In the courtrooms of Justitia Civilis and in the halls of justice, feelings of enmity and vindictiveness are intensified. But the state, society, justice, this is the Justitia Civilis, does not care about its failure to restore friendship or to bring people closer to each other. It is beyond and above the purview of Justitia Civilis. Shalom is outside of its jurisdiction. In fact, it couldn't achieve this goal even if it wanted and attempted to do so. Because where there is total victory and total defeat, there cannot be peace. There cannot be reconciliation. Shehadus, by urging both parties to retreat, to abate their exaggerated or sometimes even justified claims, to retreat from their points of vantage, to give up and to give away, has changed the role of the Dayan from a magistrate into that of what? Of a teacher. He tells both parties, both litigants, that are both wrong, that the claims of both are unjustified, absurd. The Shefet makes the litigants understand that neither of them was totally right or totally wrong. This is not just a verdict. This is not just judicial action. This is teaching. This is instruction. This is enlightenment. This is not just rendering a psagdin, a verdict. He enlightens them, of course, in consequence. He enlightens them in consequence. It becomes clear to them that hostility and hate are out of place, and that the whole conflict was not worth the emotional excitement it caused. As a result of Pshore, peace and friendship are reestablished. Emes Mishpat Shalom Shiftu Bishorechem. Interesting is that the Mechilte in Shmais,
concerning the word Vidaiti. Kiyilem dova boelai vishafateti ben ishu ben reyu. So Omar Rabbi Yeshua ben Kocho, or I don't remember the name, Zui Apshore. Shelachar sheniftorin, after they depart from the halls of justice, from the courtroom, Arenish Arim Reim, they remain friends. What I said is no, what shall I say, no discovery by me. It was expressed many, many, many years ago by somebody. Who is it? Yeah? You should know that because it's quite a familiar text. There is a very enigmatic statement in Pure Torah. In the first parish. Yehuda ben Tabai Emer, Altaf Atzmocho Ke'echei Hadayonim, Ukeshiyu Baladin Endim Lefonecho, Yir Beinecho Kirishoim, Ukeshenifthorim Lefonecho, Yir Beinecho Kezakoim, Keshekibu Aleim Hadim. Let me translate it. And it is the true translation. I mean, you can check the so-called standard translation of Aphoris. They're all erred in translating the word Eichei Hadayonim. What does Eichei Hadayonim mean? Do not act, or do not assume the role, or do not act like an all-knowing justice. Eichei Hadayonim means an all-knowing omniscient justice, all wise, all knowing justice, omniscient justice, who determines who is right and who is wrong with a sense of absolute certitude. The term Erech Din is a divine attribute. Error. It's not what this, the term is used in modern Hebrew. A lawyer, an attorney, barrister, you know. The killer didn't mean to invoke God as the barrister or as the attorney. The Keil Erer Din means to whom justice is clear, who knows the principles of justice, the way a person knows is familiar with the food items on a table which is set. You know the expression, Shulchan Aruch, why is Shulchan Aruch? A set table, why is the code of law? Why is the code of law called the Shulchan Aruch? Well, why is it? Because Shulchan Aruch means if things are just, I mean, mixed up on the table, so you can't find anything. But if the table is set properly, I mean, you can find everything in its proper place, the knives and the forks and the spoons and the plates, and then when food is served, you know what to take and how to take, how much to take. This is Mekel Eradin, means God who is omniscient and knows all the aspects, all the ways of justice. Altas Eid Atzmecho. Not Ke'echei Hadayonim, but Ke'echei Hadinim. Don't consider yourself. Don't look upon yourself. This pride, as if you were omniscient, all-knowing, all-wise. You are not omniscient. You are not wise. Hence, what don't you know? Who is right, who is wrong? Who is the Roshe, who is the Tzaddik? Who should win, who should lose? When the litigants are standing before thee, Sheyir Baladin Eindim Lefanecho, look upon them as guilty.
both are wrong. And when they depart from thee, from thy presence, look upon them as innocent, as soon as they have accepted the sentence. What does Yehuda ben Tabbai preach here? First of all, humility on the part of the lion is the first prerogative. Only God can mete out justice in absolute sense of the word. Man, the lion, is a human being, limited, restricted by being finite. He cannot determine guilt and innocence. If he attempts to determine guilt or innocence, he is usurping the prerogative of God, who is the only Eirer Din. In general, there is no sharp division within the human society. It is hard sometimes to single out the sinner, as it is almost impossible to single out the saint. The philosophy of Pshore recommends a paradoxical approach. First, that Rabbi Yehuda ben Tabbai said. We said before, the Pshore rests upon the premise that both parties are wrong and both parties are right. The question is, how you operate with this premise. Because the premise itself contains an inner contradiction. So Yehuda ben Tabbai said, before you render the decision, consider both parties as wrong, as guilty. And hence, if you consider both parties as guilty, so what will you do? You tell both to give up, to renounce, to give away, to abate their unjustified claims. Both must make amends and reduce their claims after they had agreed to give up. Pronounce both of them as right. This is the doctrine which is actually based on what? Which is nurtured by the idea of Yom Kippur. This whole concept of forgiveness and atonement and absolution and vidui is based upon one premise. Namely, what is the premise? That man can never be totally right, so everybody is a sinner. However, if man can never be right, everybody is a sinner. By saying that, you lock the gates of truth. But the next minute we have to say, it's again a contradiction between two judgments. Both are true. The next minute say, since no man can be absolutely right, so no man can be absolutely wrong. He is not completely wicked. There is something good to him. There is a spark which has not been extinguished yet. There is something which, if stimulated, may cause him to rise, to greater heights than before. Vayim Mochorot, it was on the morrow of Yom Kippur, Vayeshev Meshev, Mishpei Tesorom. Moses always remembered, while he was sitting in judgment, that Mishpot, that to practice Mishpot, and to act like a shepherd, one must be aware of the innkeeper outlook on guilt and innocence, crime and punishment, quarrel, enmity, and reconciliation. That a day of judgment, any day of judgment, must always fall on the moral of innkeeper. And Meshe was taught to act like that by a great rabbi. I'm Yom Kippur. Name of my own. I don't know my name. He looks upon the world first. This is how Rosh Hashanah, basically. Here is where you see the distinction of Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. How Rosh Hashanah? Miyizekeh lefanecha badin. If man appeals before the bar of infinite justice, who can actually win a case? He is wrong completely. Every man is wrong. There's not a single individual, not a single human being who is right. Wrong. But on the other hand, the next minute you say, yes, man is wrong. But however, he's not completely wrong. He's not totally wrong. There is something good in him. He's not totally wicked. There is something beautiful in him. All he needs is help and encouragement. And this help and encouragement came to Moshe on the famous Yom Kippur from God himself, and it is the task of Moshe, and not only Moshe, but all of his successors throughout Jewish history, to extend the helping hand to anyone, even though he might appear to be very wicked and bad. This is the motto of the Shevet. This is the motto of the Cheshen Mishpot. And this is the motto of Yom Kippur. Vahim mochoros. Vayeshev meshe. Rishpei teso om. Only the mochoros did meshe judge the people. But there was not only one mochoros. There were many mochoros. Then he had a meshe set in judgment. He thought of his encounter with the Almighty. And that mysterious Yom Kippur, the first Yom Kippur which Moshe has observed. Now, at this juncture, I thought I prepared a short shiur, I don't know. At this juncture, are you tired? We'll stop here. No. I'm fully in the machos. Extension of it. At this juncture, we arrive at a new conclusion that the usual traditional semantics of the verb shofit is wrong. The semantics of the verb terem shofet is wrong. Okay. Shofet. Right? You can pronounce it in Svari? I can't. I don't know. Shofet does not denote judicial action exclusively. What do you call judging? Our assumption that shefet or magistrate or dayan are identical terms is wrong. The semantics of shofet is all-inclusive and point toward the totality of human relationships. Let me explain. That shofet represents more than mere judging, and that it embraces the whole gamut of human relations. And I'll try to prove it to you. When we read the Psalms of Kabbalah Shabbos, we come across a very strange phenomenon. For instance, we read Yisfuch HaShomayim V'Sodirot Yiram HaYom Umlei Yal Yisodai V'Chol HaShobei Oz Yiranu Kol HaTziyuach
ולפני יד השם כבוא לשפט אורץ לשפטבו בצדק ועם במנוסת let heavens be glad let the earth rejoice let the sea roar let the fields exult let the trees of the wood sing why? What's the reason? What is the occasion? Why should the whole nature somehow dance and sing and roar and be exalted? Because God came, is coming, the process of coming, to judge the world. If God is coming to judge the world, then fear and terror, as described in the Sadeh Teket, not joy, song, and ecstatic dance are in place. Strange. In Temase Emek Hadin, Meizikel Efanecho Badin. And you know how we meet HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Rosh Hashanah. Fear and trembling. And here, suddenly, David, the psalmist says, no, dance and rejoice and shout and roar and sing because God is coming to judge the world. The same in the next chapter. The same problem arises when we read in the following chapter. Shoma v'tismach tzien v'togil lo b'nei Yehuda v'man mishpatech v'adishem yiram ha'yom umleh Tevel v'yeshvevo Norei simcha uchov Zachadorim yiraneinu Lifnei Adishem. What is the occasion? Kvolish petorot Yishvetevo betzadek vanu neshorim. When God judges creation V'yom adinu achron U'malochim yichotezun V'chivorodo yichizun V'yem reneyem adin bo Mishpet al Slomorim Badin. Can he use the camera for now, Chabarim? To show the opposite of what David said. To show the reverse. When God judges, is ready to judge creation, who can say that he will be found not wanting? Only a madman can say that. אם תמצא עם הקדין מייזקה לפניך בעיר. The answer in this, to this question is to be found in what? In the multiple semantics of the verb שופט. כבוא לשפט אורץ means God is coming from his transcendental from the transcendental distances, from the mysterious beyond, to commune with this world, not to judge, to commune. He will come close to creation, closer to creation, establish contact, show his concern and interest, involve himself in the destiny of man in general and in the destiny of his elected community in particular. Nearness of the Shofet means nearness, to be near, to be involved, to be united, to communicate, to commune, to share, to give friendship, and to be together. Not to judge. Not to examine man whether he's wanting or not wanting. If Shofet means nearness of the Creator to his creation, if Shofet means closeness of man to God, then Shofet indeed inspires joy and rapture. What is more exalted and what is more sublime than to feel the touch of infinity upon the shoulder. second proof, second argument. The Greek and Latin translations of the Sefer Shaftim, we have a Sefer Shaftim, called this book Judges, you know that very well. This translation is erroneous. And I'll prove it to you. Let us take a simple sentence and analyze it. Udvero isho nevio, eishos lapidus, ishiftos Yisroel bo eisahi, vayal uvne Yisroel aleo la mishpat. Now Deborah was a prophetess, the wife of Lapidot, she judged Israel. This is the way the standard translation was. She judged Israel at that time, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. Is this narrow rendition, narrow and limited tradition of the word shofet be true, then the whole story makes no sense. All Deborah had to do is to resolve civil conflicts and render judicial decisions, then why did she act as a queen? Not just as a queen, pro forma, but as a queen endowed with power. Nothing has been told us about our main preoccupation, namely judging the people. However, what was recorded about her life is her dedication to the people and her authority to determine the destiny of the people. She declared the war on Sisera. She chose the commander-in-chief to lead the Israelite troops against the legions of Sisera. She personally accompanied Barak to the field of battle. She, with Barak, pursued Sisera. She sang the great hymn of joy and praise. Does a magistrate do all those things? Does a judge declare war? Does a judge choose the commander-in-chief? Does a judge, I mean, pursue the enemies? Was being defeated? Does a judge pray, sing a hymn of praise? Apparently she was more than a judge. She was preoccupied not only with administering justitia civilis, but with the destiny, with determining the destiny of the people. She was more than a justice. She was a queen, leader, teacher, and friend of the people. Yishevto es Yisroel beisahi should be translated, and she did guide and taught the children of Israel at that time. Not she judged. She guided, led, and taught the children of Israel at that time. Vayalu bnei Yisroel aleo lamishpot should be translated, and the children of Israel came up to her for guidance, counsel, advice, to be taught and trained and educated. The same is true of all Shaftim. Shaftim is not the book of the judges, but the book of the leaders, not of the judges. Vayishpet Shmuel es Yisroel kol yimei chayot. Samuel judged the people? Oh, no. He led the people. He guided the people. He determined policy. He carried out policy. He shaped the people. The spiritual image of the people. He projected the spiritual image of the people. That he did all his life, but not just judging. Third proof. You still remember the phrase? Let us ask a simple question about the parasha we read last Shabbos. The Jews were in the desert, true? They were provided with food, clothes, and all other necessary. Correct? There was no need to win the daily bread in the sweat of the countenance. There was no need in the middle. So you know the story. Vayachil chol saman, simlos chol evolso melecho, v'rad lochol eva teiko. He fed thee the manna by raiment, waxed not old upon thee, neither did thy foot swell. There was no camels, there was no industry or manufacture of goods, there was no competition, there was no grabbing and seizing and stealing and robbing. There was no place for commercial feuds, for economic conflicts. If somebody tried to hoard the manna for the next day, he was punished at once. The manna bred worms and rotted. If one attempted to grab more than the ratio allotted to him, by the time he came home from picking the manna, the additional measure which he stole disappeared. In short, cheating, grabbing, stealing were impossibilities. Now a question arises. Why were there so many litigants standing up near Moses that Moshe had to spend the whole day from the morning until the evening sitting in judgment? What did he judge? What did he quarrel about? The Bnei Shalom, what was there? The whole sentence. Vayeshev Meshe Lishpoet Esoam is mystifying. It's puzzling. However, the puzzle is cleared up with the change of the semantics of Shofet. If Shofet denotes the total spectrum, if Shofet means related to the total spectrum of human relations, beginning with leadership, but concluding with love, concern, and unqualified friendship, then we understand what Moses used to do the whole day. Of course, there was not much need for judicial action, for civil justice. However, there was a great and awesome need for leadership, for teaching, and particularly for giving friendship to the people. There were perhaps not many civil controversies. Requiring Moshe's attention. But there was a myriad of human problems.